You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome back to Amazing Avenue Audio, the show. I am Brian. With me, as always, is Chris. And we've got a very different show than we had last week. You and I were talking before we started recording, Chris, about how different the show feels. Not the show, rather the team feels today versus a week ago. Obviously, winning goes a long way. Obviously, taking 2 out of 3 from the Tigers should have been easy because the Tigers are a bad team. But, you know, all those things sort of led to this sort of this sense of confidence in the team. But also, the last 2 games in L.A., the team has looked okay. I mean, they lost Monday night's game because of some bad bullpen performances, but they hung in there around, you know, with Kershaw. And I think the team just feels very, very different right now than it did, you know, a week, 2 weeks ago. So how much of this is for real? Are the Mets more the team that we had 10 days ago, or are they more the team that we have right now?
I guess I'd say more right now, only because my very unbold prediction for the season was that it could go any way and make sense. So to be exactly 500 at the time that we're recording this, and obviously they got there on Sunday. They lost the game. They won a game. They got back to that point. It's fitting. I don't necessarily think they'll finish 81-81, but that's certainly in the range of outcomes that you might expect. So, yeah, what's nice is that last year, May just really did them in. You know, they had a nice record the rest of the way. It didn't matter. So they avoided that complete spiral. And even though there have been in-game decisions that Mickey Callaway has made over the last week, double switching Pete Alonso out of a tie game in the 9th being the most egregious, yeah. It's looking like staying the course with that decision and with some of the other decisions has been the right move. Obviously that could change. I wouldn't put big money on the Mets going on a tear and making it back to the postseason, but they went through a tough stretch. They've rebounded from it. And, you know, they're in a spot now that the division is still in play. It certainly helps that the division has just been weaker than everybody predicted it to be, but that's okay. You know, that's part of what you do when you try to compete in Major League Baseball. You have to stay relevant in your division, even with 2 wild cards.
Right.
So yeah, it's – I'm not – I'll put it this way, I guess. When they sent out a thing yesterday saying – it's the deadline for prorated 20-game plans. I didn't buy a ticket plan. You know, I'm not that confident that
right.
Things have gone well, but things are they're okay. And the longer you can go through a season and feel like, hey, this week of games coming up matters, the more enjoyable I think baseball is.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think that it's a very good sign that the Mets are playing a team that everybody thinks is considerably better than them, and they're not being knocked around so hard that it's laughable, you know. And obviously, baseball's a game where even the worst team you know, in the league is going to win 50 games. But, you know, teams can look overmatched often. And the Mets this series haven't looked overmatched yet. And I think that's a good sign just for how they are doing in terms of their confidence and just, you know, sort of projecting out what you hope the team can do the rest of the way. And the reason I say projecting out the rest of the way is because the Mets still have a fair amount of their roster on the disabled list. You know, off the top of my head, Seth Lugo, Justin Wilson, Robinson Cano, Jeff McNeil, Brandon Nimmo, Jed Lowry. Anybody else I'm forgetting? Technically, Yoenis Cespedes.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, we've gotten to a point that we know he's on the injured list through the end of the season.
Right, yeah.
But that's
a fifth of the starting day, or even a fourth of the starting day, the opening day roster.
Yeah.
You know, it's crazy.
Yeah, no, it's, I feel like, was it one or two episodes ago that I brought up, oh, they haven't had to deal with that many injuries yet. And
yeah,
it was either immediate or fairly shortly after that they had them all crop up. But on top of some of the returns sounding like they're a little bit closer, Cano's case, they haven't said exactly when, but it sounds like he's going to be back relatively soon. On top of that, Conforto actually coming back, you know, he hit the grand slam that was essentially the difference in the victory on Tuesday night. We keep saying it, and I think it's true. I know Allison tweeted something to this effect, and it's come up a couple of times that I've written about him. He kind of flies under the radar, and he's a really good hitter. For the regulars, he is the Mets' best hitter this year, and that's not exactly surprising.
Right. Yeah. It's also been nice to see, and I am not ready to extend him. Don't get me wrong. It's been nice to see Todd Frazier hitting the last couple days.
Yeah.
You know, just having him not be an offensive black hole has been a really nice thing. And, you know, you hope that he makes the decision tough when everyone gets healthy of sort of who's going to be playing, because you hope that he continues this. But, I mean, he looked absolutely done 2 weeks ago.
Right. And as someone who has defended players who are over 30 and adamantly defended Curtis Granderson just about a couple of years ago, almost exactly, it's... And it's just a reminder that, yes, of course, players have decline phases at some point. I mean, the best of the best of the best maintain an above average level of play and retire and await their Hall of Fame induction. But, you know, for the most part, every player looks human at some point. But most of the time, and I know that we might have experienced the opposite of this as Mets fans over the years, but most of the time a guy doesn't go from being a useful, productive hitter. And I'm not saying Frazier necessarily was last year, but he was below league average by WRC plus, but not drastically below. So I guess my overall point here is guys don't usually just completely fall off a cliff from 1 year to the next. I think it's typically a little bit more gradual than that. So his resurgence, his climb back to a respectable batting line, he's not there yet, but you know, as he goes in that direction, it's a reminder that he wasn't necessarily going to go from good, useful major league hitter at the age of 31 to completely gone from Major League Baseball at 33.
Right. Although I will say that I think that Frazier has one of the odder skill sets in baseball. Like, he doesn't... To me, I could see him aging very weirdly based on the type of player he is, I guess is what I'm saying. there are certain players where I think it's pretty easy to predict what their decline will look like. But because of the type of player Frazier is, I don't think that I necessarily can tell you. I mean, I can't tell you how anyone's going to decline definitively, but you understand what I'm saying. Like, there are certain players you just know, like, once their bat speed goes, that's it. Or once their wheels go, that's it. You know, he doesn't have, he's an interestingly constructed player in terms of what he's good at. So I don't know what his decline is going to look like.
Yeah, I think that's fair. It's something that came up with Keon Broxton too. And not that he's in the same phase of his career or not that he has the major league track record that Frazier had. But it's the Ted Burke song. You got to let things play out a little bit more before you make definitive conclusions. And it's easy to see a guy and, you know, we know his age. We know what he's done. And it's easy to start thinking the worst and then get into confirmation bias. And I think Curtis Granderson's toast. And I went to a game in person and he struck out 3 times. That notion is hard to shake. And I feel like the one thing with baseball, and I'm not writing off the decline that can happen with guys, but the one thing with baseball that we should learn on a year-to-year basis is that you got to give things time to shake out. And a month from now, Todd Frazier might have plummeted and he may be toast. And I'm not saying he necessarily even should start every day if the Mets ever get to a fully healthy infield roster, if Jed Lowrie ever plays a game as a Met.
If he exists, we can't be sure he exists anymore.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, he's in PSL purgatory. And I like Port St. Lucie. Don't get me wrong. I like it for a week.
Yeah. Say no more. to me, the player that, aside from Frazier, has been the most pleasant surprise, and this is one that I don't think you can count on in any way to continue. And that's no offense to him. I hope I'm wrong. I hope I'm on this podcast in 3 months talking about, you know, surefire National League MVP Adani Echevarria. But, you know, he's really looked quite good as of late. And not just the home runs. He's been taking good at bats. He had a crucial walk in last night's game. He's been playing a decent second base in Cano's, you know, stead. And to me, the most hilarious thing, and hilarious maybe is the wrong word for it, but I don't know if you heard Mickey Callaway's comments that apparently they had to work really hard to sign him, that they took him out to dinner on Valentine's Day. Did you hear this?
Yes, I remember that.
which is, you know, again, just a very strange thing for the team to do for Adani Echevarria. We were lamenting a few weeks ago on the podcast, you know, them even bringing him up because we felt like it was a waste of money. You know, that he'll make like $3 million or so this season because he was called up, and how we felt that money could be better used elsewhere. I still feel there is better use of money in baseball than Adani Echevarria, but I have to say it's been nice watching him play a little bit. What have your impressions of him been?
Well, the power certainly has been surprising, and it's not like he's a guy who had zero major league home runs to his name, but usually it's been, I don't know, at a slower rate than this, I think is a fair way of putting it. His isolated slugging right now is .275. For his career, it's .093. So, there's somewhat of a lightning in a bottle kind of thing going on with him right now. And he's already done more than I would have ever expected when they signed him. You know, it's something that I do not expect to continue. And I'm rooting for it too, of course. If you're a player, barring specific circumstances, that have nothing to do with baseball, if you're generally, if you're a player wearing a Mets uniform, I'm rooting for you to succeed, whether I liked you as a player before or not. And you even hear players express things like that. Who was it? Was it McNeil or was it somebody else? No. It was O'Rourke. I got my Irish names mixed up there. But it was O'Rourke who had said that he had pitched against Gomez and hated him at some point in his career, and then wound up on the same team as Gomez and was like, oh, this guy's awesome. He's the best. When he's on my team, I love him. You know, so that there's that factor. I fully expect Echevarria to return to his career norms. And in his defense, he's generally rated as a slightly positive war player, even when he's hitting very, very poorly. So obviously that's heavily dependent on his defense. But yeah, it's Rajai Davis hit a big home run, and Hetch has hit three home runs, and as you said, worked other at bats that were significant. You know, I don't think we're looking at a revelation that he's suddenly figured it out, but it's nice when you get those things to break your way. When this, you know, 2019 Rajai Davis and Carlos Gomez and Echevarria come in and give you contributions at a time that you really need them, it makes it fun.
Well, I was talking to my father-in-law about this recently because he's a big Mets fan too. And we were saying that if the Mets had not signed every seemingly washed up or close to washed up outfielder they could get to a minor league deal late in spring, who would be playing for the Mets right now? You know, we talked about this on the show a little bit too, a couple weeks ago, but you know, it's really been a nice thing to see these depth signings work out. And all you need them to do is work out in the short term. You don't need to find an everyday player from those minor league signings, but the fact that they have Echevarria playing second base for the 10 days or so Cano's going to be out, you know, and holding his own and hitting a couple of home runs and all that really does impact your season. To not lose everything when someone's out is a huge, huge boon. And I think that the combination of Rajai Davis and Carlos Gomez and Gregor Blanco and whoever else the Mets sign, all those guys over the course of the season will definitely not equal out to if you had a full, healthy season of Brandon Nimmo, let's say, right? But getting a full, healthy season of anybody these days is risky. I mean, not just these days, any day is risky. So I guess this is a long-winded way of me, again, praising the parts of the team that Brody Van Wagenen decided needed depth and lamenting that he didn't take this same attitude towards starting pitching. Because for not a lot of money, he could have done the same thing for the starting pitching.
Right. And to a certain extent, the bullpen too.
Yes. Agreed. I'm a little bit more forgiving on the bullpen, if only just because bullpen guys are so hard to predict. But anybody could have told you the Mets would have needed starting pitching depth. You know?
Yeah.
Is there anybody else that you particularly want to talk about in terms of the Mets, you know, their role players, you know, stepping up?
I guess Gomez a little more just himself, because he's a guy who, I don't know, it might be easy to romanticize it because he came up through the system, made his debut with the Mets, was obviously a significant piece in the non-trade in 2015. The whole history of it all. But if I'm going to say Frazier's not totally washed at 33, or at least suggest that he might not be, then I should be doing the same for Gomez, who's the same age. So Yeah, look, I don't think he's going to recapture what he did in his breakout years with the Brewers. Those, that was 5 years ago, was the most recent one, But he is a guy who in 2017 had a slash line that looks fairly similar to what he's doing now. Not identical, but he's not that old and the success isn't that long ago where I could see him being a fun player to watch, somebody who brings joy to the game because of the way he plays it, but also comes up with things that helps the team win games. So yeah, it's ideally I want him to be the fourth or fifth outfielder on a healthy team, but I don't know. Of all these guys, he's the one who I could say he might stick around if Nimmo's neck thing, and it's already gotten one step more serious.
Well, just the phrase bulging disc is never good.
Right. It was stiff neck, injured list, and then bulging disc. I hope he's back soon, and I hope his struggles earlier in the season were primarily because of that. And if it's addressed and, he's getting to a place where he feels good, feels like he can play his normal game, absolutely. I want him in there every day because we saw what he can do last year, and I don't think that was a fluke. But, man, If the team got fully healthy and had too many outfielders, which doesn't look like it's going to be the case anytime soon, but if that did happen and you needed the roster spot, I might keep Gomez over Lagares, even though diminished Lagares is still definitely a center fielder and the Mets might be short on those in that situation.
Yeah.
I'm just saying I would consider getting Lagares off the roster before Gomez.
I mean, I've known that you're a crazy person before, but this is sort of new evidence to that. I'm half kidding. To me, that is very much a lot would have to happen before I felt comfortable with that. Because I think that Lagares is, he is a worse hitter than Gomez. No one is going to argue otherwise. But I don't know if the total package of Lagares is considerably worse than the total package of Gomez. And I think that what Gomez does is not as hard to replicate out of other pieces as what Lagares does.
Yeah, I just need to see Lagares play great defense for a month or a week, just something. I need something to get me back on board with him. But beyond this year, I'm fine. If he can do that and just kind of be his average healthy self or healthiest self, I should say. This is a guy who his most played appearances in a single season over the last 3 years is 272. Mm-hmm. But if he can go out and play center field in a way, and maybe it's just the games I've seen, or maybe it's the batting line making me, be that much farther down on him that anything that goes wrong in center field, I'm fixating on. But whatever the case, if he can go out and just play that vintage A-plus center field, then I might not say things like keep Carlos Gomez instead of him. But I need to see it. I need something.
I understand that. I do. I've also long been a Lagares apologist, and I recognize that. So we shall see, I suppose. I do want to talk for a minute about Wilson Ramos.
Yeah.
Because Ramos was, even as of this time last week, a number of us on Amazing Avenue were talking about how he just seemed to lose the ability to elevate the ball in any way. He was just hitting the ball on the ground. He was hitting the opposite field a lot and getting lots of singles, but he was supposed to be a relative source of power for this team and just had not been doing anything of the sort, just not elevating anything and just generally looking like a singles hitter, which is not what you want Wilson Ramos to be. But then on Saturday, he broke out big time, drove in four runs, hit two home runs, and, you know, he's starting to look a little bit more like himself sort of historically. Do you think that Ramos is going to, at the end of the season, pull the trick that, like, the Jets do every year, where the Jets can start off great or start off terrible, but they always end the season 500? You know, is Ramos going to end the season looking like Wilson Ramos, you think?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's the last 3 years would really be overall his breakout, right? He had some nice seasons early in his career where he was a better than league average hitter, you know, put together several wins in WAR. Then he kind of dipped, and he has the LASIK surgery last three seasons. Overall, 16 and 18 were great. 17 was not so good, mainly because he didn't play all that much and didn't hit quite as well when he did. But I would bet on landing somewhere in that norm of the last 3 years. He's 31. I know catching is it takes a toll in a way that other positions don't. I know some of the things he's done behind the plate have been frustrating, but yeah, look, he's not Grandal. Neither one of them is Piazza. We're not talking about a guy who's going to hit 30, 35 home runs, but I would expect that he'll end up somewhere in the high teens, low 20s, especially given the context of what the baseball is doing this year when guys hit it in the air. So, yeah, I wouldn't say a safe bet, but I would say it's fairly likely that he winds up somewhere near the 16 through 18 level, which overall is very good for a catcher.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, being in a game in person that he dominates helps.
Yes.
You see that. There's not that it doesn't impress you when you see it on TV, but your average non-Pete Alonso division home run on TV is, oh, hey, look, that was good. Alonso, I think, is the only guy who in that format can blow you away. Yeah, I think it's much easier to be blown away by normal home runs when you see them in person, because that gives you perspective that your television just doesn't. So, I don't know. Maybe, we all have reasons to be on board with players. It could go back to the conversation with the scout who totally didn't work for the Twins, but worked for the Twins, who defended trading him away at the time, vehemently, to my Twins fan cousin and me, and us being sure that he was wrong. And the more Wilson Ramos does that's good in his career, the more I feel good about the conversation we had that night.
Yeah. And I guess sort of just before we wrap up, what's the, of all of these sort of random players that we've been seeing play a little bit here, a little bit there, is there one that you think has a legitimate shot at not just sticking around? Is there anybody that has a legitimate shot of taking, I'm trying to think of the best way to phrase this. Is there anybody who has earned themselves a playoff roster spot or is in the potential to offer that? You know, when you're really putting together your best team and you're sort of not worrying about anything but fielding the best team, Will any of these guys be in that conversation if the Mets find themselves in that position?
I guess I go back to Gomez for that, because there isn't that much outfield depth. And even if Nimmo is healthy, you're still looking at five outfielders. Six and a half, seven, depending on how you count McNeil, Davis. But Gomez seems like the guy who could be that fit. What I think in the short term will happen, especially if Hechavarria keeps up any level of production over the next few days, is people will want him starting over Cano, which is insane and wrong.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Just to be clear about it. But Gomez for the outfield depth reason, and then if you really get into like the specifics of a playoff roster, you could make an argument for Rajai Davis, because he's probably still the fastest of these guys, even though he's 38.
Sure.
So if you wanted that speed weapon in a postseason game, then you can make an argument that he makes sense for that kind of roster. So, yeah. Any differences on your side in terms of one of these guys being the one who say, hey, he might be one of the 25 best players in this organization right now?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that there's an argument to be made for Rajai Davis for the exact reason that you said, that he has a skill that is hard to come by in this organization. But I think that when you look at Gomez has the potential to be, what do you want to say, 75% that, but also bring something else that Davis is not going to bring to the plate, you know, in terms of just, you know, being a bit of a better defender and a bit of a better hitter probably at this point in his career. So I don't know. I know people are going to hate on this because we mentioned a playoff roster. I didn't mean, you know, I just meant, like you said, the best 25 players in the organization right now.
Right.
But I think that there could be a case made for, if this keeps up at all, for Echevarria to be the primary backup shortstop. I mean, backup infielder for this team. I don't know who else would even be in that consideration right now. I mean, I guess Guillorme. And I guess technically Dom Smith's a backup infielder, even though Dom Smith is really just a backup first baseman, which, right, as we all know, is a very different thing.
Although he's starting the outfield tonight.
Oh, I saw that. It's going to be an adventure. I mean, look, I guess right now you might as well try it. You got nobody else to play right now, but it just seems like a big mistake. Right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I wanted to make sure you didn't turn into a Dom Smith and left field truther over the last week or so.
No, I have been talking about this organization's rich history of playing people in the outfield who don't belong there. So I kind of think just keep doing it, because screw it, why not? But whether or not I actually root for that at all times, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I have been fond of saying in the Amazing Avenue Slack that Dom Smith is my favorite Met right now. Because I just think that you've really seen him. First of all, you've seen what the Mets maybe saw in him initially. But more than that, he just seems happy now. He just seems like he's in a good place. And I like watching people enjoy playing baseball. So good for Dom Smith in that way. And I think as a, you know, if he can be the 2019 Lenny Harris, that's great. Good for that guy. But I don't want to see him play left field ever again. So, well, after tonight. I do want to watch tonight's game. So I have to caveat there a little bit. Anyway, let's get to our music recommendations. Chris, what's your pick this week?
So Mavis Staples has made several records this decade, and there's clearly the connection a whole lot of the music she's made has been with Jeff Tweedy, who's written or in some cases co-written with her, but in a lot of cases written the songs that she's performed and produced or recorded with her. So that's been a thing that was a door that was opened by Wilco. She put out a record last week that she did basically the same thing with Ben Harper. And Ben Harper, I think, is somebody who is extremely talented, definitely one of the best live performers that I've seen, and just super humble, super down to earth, and somebody who I think may have been classified, and I don't think his 90s and early, you know, maybe early 2000s, but 90s music was bad, but there's a couple more popular songs in there that might make certain people take him less seriously than he should be taken. So he's somebody who knows how to write, who is a hell of a singer, can play guitar and sing like that all at the same time. So he did the Jeff Tweedy role, making a full album with Mavis Staples and writing or co-writing all the songs and performing on it and singing on, I think, one of them. I've listened to the album a few times. So if there's any slight factual errors, my apologies. But yeah, the album is We Get By. Just in looking at stuff for this, I didn't realize that he had written a song called Love and Trust that she recorded a few years ago that is definitely one of her best. So, you know, those two working together, it's got a very different feel from the songs she's worked on and written with Tweedy. And that's good. I mean, if you're putting out albums at the rate that she is, it's you like to hear like a little bit of a different feel.
Oh, so, absolutely, yeah.
So yeah, it's a subdued in the tone of the music. The message isn't subdued, but the overall feel of it is sort of like stripped down, bass heavy, and just relaxing, but the things she's singing about aren't any less relevant or less meaningful. So yeah, that's mine. It's a long explanation, but We Get By, Mavis Staples.
I did want to say, you know, I really only know Ben Harper by a couple of songs and then a couple of people's, like, this is going to sound so judgy of me. Like, there are a couple of kids in high school who wore Ben Harper shirts, and I judged Ben Harper based on who was wearing his t-shirts.
Right.
Which I think is something that high school kids just do, right?
Oh, yeah.
So I have never really delved into the Ben Harper catalog. So maybe I should do that.
I don't know.
We'll see.
Yeah.
Is there a place you can recommend me starting?
Let's see. I'd actually say, so he's worked with so many people.
The one album I do have by him is he was in a band with Joseph Arthur and Danny Harris and George Harrison's son called Fistful of Mercy.
Yeah.
And I like that album. So I do have that.
Yeah. So that's good. I would say his own records, starting at, let's see, White Lies for Dark Times. Most of the records he's put out since then have been not with the Innocent Criminals, which was, you know, his band's name for his first half of his career.
Right.
But the two records he made with Charlie Musselwhite, the harmonica player, those might actually be like the best window into it all. I mean, I wish he had done a live record of, he played solo at Carnegie Hall, and man, that was easily one of the best shows I've ever seen. And you know, threw in, he covered Atlantic City by Springsteen and just fucking nailed it. And he played Pearl Jam song, Indifference.
Oh, wow.
And he sang that on, and he played vibraphone and sang that. Not that the covers are the only thing that makes them, but there's just this depth to it that the records have a, they have it, but they don't quite fully capture the live.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, take of it, but yeah, it's, I think exactly what you were saying, you know, you associate memories from when he was at his most popular with like his overall image. But yeah, there's some really good stuff there. And some of those old songs, I'd still happily hear them. But, you know, having seen him and heard him just talk about it either in interviews or on stage, I know that not going back into the 90s stuff is preferable to him. You know, he I think he's at his most comfortable when he's doing the things that are from the last 10 years.
Right. Well, I'll definitely have to check that out more. So thank you for your knowledge there.
Sure.
So my choice, I'm probably going to butcher this name, but I was really sort of a casual fan of Stereolab. I was never a huge Stereolab fan.
Okay.
But somebody recommended an album that came out 2 years ago by the female singer from Stereolab, and this is the name I'm going to butcher. I believe it's Letitia Sadier.
Okay.
Her band is called the Letitia Sadier Source Ensemble, and it's, I don't want to say it's dissimilar to Stereolab, because there are elements of that, but there's a lot of, like, really interesting, like, mallet percussion, like marimba and vibraphone stuff on the album, mixed with some electronics, mixed with some just really, really good songs. And I couldn't believe when I was listening to it, like, how, one of those things where I feel like, I hate when I find something like a couple years too late. Like, why did no one tell me about this earlier? You know, and there were so many things on this album where I was like, oh my goodness, that's exactly what I would want if I were like, if I were designing an album from the top down, right? If I was saying, all right, here are the things that I want on this type of album, I would want really strong songs. I want interesting percussion. I want cool harmonies. I'd want little bits of electronics mixed in there. Like, all of that is there. It felt like this is so up my alley, and I did not find it until, you know, a couple years later. So, but anyway, that's, I'm glad I found it to begin with. It's a super engaging record. It's something that I find myself coming back to an awful lot. I found that, I guess, about a year ago, and every month or so I'll be on Spotify just, you know, looking for something to listen to, and I'll see it there in my saved albums, and I'll listen to it again, but like, oh, this is still really, really good. I feel like it's the rare album that I found the last couple of years that I didn't burn myself. I tend to be somebody who burns himself out on an album for a little while. I'll listen to the same thing, like, you know, for 2 weeks straight, and then I won't touch it for a while. And I've never felt burned out on this album in the year I've been listening to it. So that's
nice. Yeah, that's
high praise from me.
Yes.
So yeah, that's my choice. The name of the album, I don't know if I said it, is "Find Me, Finding You" by Letitia Sadier. And that's going to do it for us this week. We do have an amazing avenue in conversation tomorrow, a very fun one. Chris and I just recorded it before we did this, and we were saying, like, maybe it'll go 20 minutes. Maybe it'll go 25 minutes. It went an hour, about.
In the spirit of Jeff.
Yes, yes.
It's only appropriate that the Josh Satin conversation went longer than expected.
Yes, exactly. It is our tribute to our friend Jeffrey. Definitely come back and check that out. Go to AmazingAvenue.com, where you can read lots of great stuff about the Mets. You can hear our fellow podcasts, which we are super proud of and are a lot of fun. You can find those podcasts on Apple Podcasts, on Stitcher, on Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. You can find those. Please rate, review, and subscribe. That helps us out quite a bit. You can follow Chris on Twitter. He's at Chris McShane. I'm at Brian Needs a Nap. And I think that'll do it for this week. So hopefully the Mets have another two good games in L.A. And then we can hopefully be talking this time next week about the Mets having a nice road trip ahead of their return to Citi Field. And so until then, let's go Mets.